Tommy might be over there listening to Price. Oh, you were? You mean for the service?
Yeah.
But I meant for the convocation.
Oh, well,
you invited. Yeah. Yeah, he ought to have a very good talk, for sure. But you can get it on tape, too. Yeah, I hope we get a copy of it. Okay. Yeah, I will. Alrighty.
Okay.
We usually start if you have a question or something on your mind. You know, you have that, you know, just a little background there. And I believe that Professor Schmelder occasionally will, like last year he did, he gave a history of that background. And if you get the chance, you should really go there and listen to him. Because, you know, you need to know the history. You just do. I consider our sin like a sleeping giant. You know, if we could ever get off this stewardship thing, away from money, and start really moving out, we could open 200-300 churches a year without any trouble. My former assistant pastor, Peter Krauske, was in New Orleans. He phoned me up last week. He went there. They have no land, no church. He's a missionary at large. The land is $1.2 million for 4 acres. You know, he's got no money or nothing. So what's he going to do? And he phoned up and he found out there's a piece of land in the Choice area for about $200,000 for 4 acres. And right beside the school they can use. And so the Lord really does lead if you just, you know, I'm surprised at that level, you know, how quickly a church can start. And if you have any questions before we move into the third commandment, we'll wait till she comes back. Anything happened during the week? Anybody interesting services Sunday?
I got asked a question by a Catholic girl.
Oh, yeah.
And if you wanted me to ask
this, sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I know the answer already is that she's married.
Yeah. Mormons have a real good answer.
Yeah.
I wish we were Mormons. I don't know how a woman could ever want to be a Mormon, but boy, guys, that's great. Have her own planet with 20 wives. What did you answer her?
Well, I kind of said, I didn't know the exact Bible passage. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. Yeah, that's the one I think they're thinking of. There's no marriage or giving in marriage, Jesus says, when he's speaking with the Pharisees. The no male or female is Paul in Galatians, where he's talking about from God's point of view as he regards us in salvation. There's no distinction between male or female. And the no weeping passage is Revelation. You know, chapter 20. So you have three passages there. But all of them do deal with heaven. That's right. And there is male and female in heaven. It's just that there's no giving or taking in marriage, so that the marriage relationship will no longer continue in heaven. And he'll be with both wives, but not in a sexual sense.
And there will be no, like, we won't feel towards
That'd be interesting. See, if I answer, one would think. But you know, if you give an answer, I have to back it up with a Bible verse. You know, and the problem here is that God hasn't provided us much revelation concerning heaven. And it's very easy to understand why he hasn't. Because any time he reveals that which is hidden, it's always in a dimension for which we have no parallel. So he always has to compare it to something we're familiar with, which is always a subcategory of what it really is. Like when he talks about himself, The only way he describes himself is in negatives. Like he says he is almighty. Well, what does that mean? We have no concept of almighty. We can't even think of almighty in a sense. You know, you can say that he can do everything and things like that. But what it really means is there's nothing that is impossible for him. It's a negative concept. But as to, you know, who his nature is and what he really is, there's nothing in our creation. So he uses analogy. Now, that's all a theology is. Is God using analogy to compare himself to things somewhat that he's like. But we always see through a mirror darkly. In heaven, the glory of God will so, in fact, it's so fantastic, even the angels can't stand it right now. The angels can't stand it. They have to hide their wings, Isaiah, over their eyes and such. And when God appeared to Moses, an analogy was his backside, you know, as he moved away from Moses. And the glory of on the Mount Sinai, even Moses' face shone for a while, and that was just a speck of God's glory. But that's why Job is so tremendous, because you will see God with your own eyes. With my own eyes, I will see the Lord. You know, we say that every funeral. So when God is describing heaven, because it's a dimension that is so unlike anything we have, you can only do it. I can't imagine how there's no weeping and how your emotions stay the same to everyone when you know maybe your child's in hell.
So that
no, that's very difficult to understand.
The most important relationship in that place will be our relationship to God.
To Christ Jesus. That's right.
I don't really feel that we'll have hang-ups on human relationships.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And I said that to one of my friends. And I said, oh, I'm so happy for that.
Yeah.
And I said, I have three adopted children. Now, who will be their mother?
Yeah. That's a very good point. I didn't even think of that, something like that. That's very good.
My daughter's mother will say, that's my daughter. And I'll say, no, it's my daughter.
No.
Mother won't be anymore.
No.
So I don't really feel that there will be any
demanding
human relationship.
Mm-hmm. She hasn't been married very long, has she? The one you're talking about. Less than 2 years, I'll bet you.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was weird, but I sat down at once.
Yeah.
You know, it was really exciting to do.
I know.
Because I don't even know all the answers of the past.
No, you don't. No, no, you don't. No. No, he doesn't. No.
But that's the concept.
I don't know. I really don't think so.
Out in the world. Oh, I think so.
Yeah, I think because you're related, Pastor, they imagine you'd be able to. But all you do, and I tell this to my people all the time, all you do is say, you know, I'll, you know, ask the resources. You know, there's many resources. You know, if it's not the pastor, then when I don't know an answer, I can go to books. You know, because every question has always been asked. And sometimes you have to say, I don't know the answer. There is no answer. You know, if I likewise some and not others. The what I consider the question of all Christianity.
Theological thing, of course, they ask the pastor. Well,
that's right.
Right.
But see, what are pastors equipped for at the seminary? And I think this helped me an awful lot. I was under the impression we were equipped to learn all the answers. We aren't. All we are equipped to do is to learn how to find the answers. That's a really big difference. That's right, and it teaches you how to study. For instance, some people stay in graduate school because they've only gone through like Romans and John and Revelation, and they like to go through also Mark and such. But the point is you don't take those books to learn about those books primarily. You take those books to learn the hooks of theology. I like to talk about the hooks of theology. And basically what those hooks are confessions. You know, when a woman comes to me and says, you know, Pastor, you know, I'm not a member of the church, but I'd like to have my child baptized because Grandma in California would feel better. Immediately, certain hooks come down from my theology. First of all, baptism, then infant baptism, and then the responsibility of parents toward it, the faith of the parents in regard to baptism, is it necessary, this kind of thing. And these all come down. Now, I have, when I leave the seminary and I get ordained, I promise that no longer is the Bible my norm. The confessions are now the norm. The confessions interpret the Bible for me. That's a very critical difference. That's why I'm a Lutheran pastor, not a Roman Catholic. I go to the seminary for 4 years to find out if the confessions correctly understand the Bible. And then when I leave, the confessions now help me understand the scriptures. I use the confessions to interpret the scriptures. And one of our confessional teachings is the distinction between law and gospel. See, that's a confessional teaching. That's very important, because then every time a question comes, like the question that you did, the first thing that comes to mind is, there were three things that came to my mind: love, heaven, and marriage. She was asking really those three questions. She has such a love relationship with her husband right now, and so close to him, she can't imagine a heaven where that doesn't continue. And if she dies, you know, that worries her. See?
She said that she loves her husband so much.
That's right. That's right. You don't have to deal with husband and wife. I got people who are going to be, who are upset because they're not sure their pets are going to be in heaven. And that, every time you hear that question, you know, is my dog going to be in heaven? Forget the question. They're always, the question is always about God. Every theological question always is a question about God. Now, what's the problem there? Their problem is they are wondering whether their view of love is God's view of love. And their view of fellowship and happiness is God's view. I'm happy when my dog is around me, and boy, I'm not going to be in heaven. Like one guy, I guess Peter Krause, I was my assistant, he gave a tremendous answer. A guy was on his deathbed. He said, well, I'd be able to fish in heaven, because that's what he loved. And Krause, he said this to him. He said, you know, I don't know if there's fishing or not in heaven, but one thing I'll tell you is that if fishing is the only thing that's going to make you happy in heaven, God will have it for you. That was a really an insightful answer, because he was saying to him that you will be in total bliss in heaven. And whatever it takes, that'll be there. Now, I personally don't think there's fishing, because there's no death. When you catch a fish, the thing dies, you know. Why do you catch fish?
You know, I hope that everybody doesn't have to change
that. No, you do.
You know,
when I was a kid, that was the whole thing of heaven. Nothing but a big choir.
And she says, I love to hear the singing, but I can't sing, and I just want to make the soup.
Well, that's what I always ask, is there eating in heaven?
Oh, yeah. And there will be no calories. There will be no calories in the food.
Well, will it be eating?
Yes.
Will there will?
That's heaven, when there's no calories in the food.
Well.
You don't have to worry.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're doing here now, we're taking an analogy of us. You know, heaven is like, but you can't say heaven is. That's right. You know, in the front of the Bible, it talks about a Garden of Eden from which we fell. In the back of the Bible, it talks about heaven described like the Garden of Eden to which we're going. Everything in between is how God gets us there. So you can say that the heaven to which we're going is like the old Garden of Eden. The trees are there, the tree of life. But there's two things. There's one thing we mentioned today that's not in heaven. That is in the Garden of Eden, and it's taking and giving in marriage. Now, they also ate in the Garden of Eden. Well, it won't be there. But the eating, I don't know. Now, in his glorified body, Jesus ate. Remember, he ate the fish in order to show that he had a true body. He wasn't just a spirit. But, so I usually use that to show that there is the possibility of eating in heaven. You know, only do that for people who really like eating. We really enjoy going like to a Ponderosa or a White Castle, these real high places. There's no, it was just a way, a euphemism for Tom, but there's no sexual intercourse. And there's no babies going to be coming in heaven. Right? So giving and taking in marriage is a...
What's the Bible about?
Boy. I keep thinking it's obviously in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, or John. That one, I'm just not sure. I thought it was Matthew where he talks about, the concordance with him. Just look up marriage. I can give you the verses, but I... I have it right here. I lucked out then. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven. Like angels of God, see? In that sense, like angels of God, in the sense, not that they're spirits, not that they're sexless, but that they don't have marriage. They don't have children.
That's not a need any longer.
Obviously, that would be true. Because anything that we won't have in heaven won't supply a need. That's right.
That's weird. You don't want to continue on if you are here.
Well, let's put it this way. There are certain levels of ecstasy that individuals have. Some people, boy, when they have like a good Chinese meal, man, nothing's better than that. And then a marriage is another area. Relationship. Father-child, mother-child. But the one that I can think of that would be like heaven, have you ever been in a really tremendous high-level service, worship service, where everything just clicking together? Then your husband or wife, that isn't the focus of your happiness right there. It's the joy of the Lord. First, I was coming over here listening to Camel X, and they got this new Calypso song on for Christmas. Really a good one. And they say there's 90 copies in 7030 Manchester, where I'm heading right after this. that's all they cut in the whole town. It's made in Canada, but it's an excellent Christmas song. And it talks about Jesus, and it really is very Lutheran. I was really surprised about, you know, forgiving our sins and all this, and on Camel X. But I was really enjoying that song, and, you know, that was a level of happiness and such that it didn't matter if my wife was there or not. And so you do go through different ecstasies. And all that heaven is going to be is of such an ecstasy that your husband or your wife or your spouse or your parents will, you know, just flow in very easily. And you won't have this need of, like when you're in a high-level church service, I don't mean high church, I mean a very good, inspiring, a good sermon. Really hits home, the hymns, everything just clicking right together. You don't look to your spouse and say, well, I can hardly wait till I get to your bed. You're just not there. And that's what heaven is going to be.
You know, when they interview people who are about to die,
yeah,
that's interesting, what they're thinking.
That's right, that's right.
And, you know, I was at death for once, and you feel such an exhilaration.
That's right.
Like, oh, you just want to go on home.
And you're ready. That's right.
And you're not thinking about any of the world and whatever.
Yeah.
It's almost like...
The only reason why God gave us that, so to speak, to populate the earth at that point. At that point. I wouldn't say for today. You know, because the earth is somewhat populated. I mean, in other words, you can be married without planning on not having children. I think that's a valid... Sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like
but you don't understand the pastor, you don't understand how God would, how you could be really at a happy stage without this. No, I think I understand what you're saying.
And Mary, and I think it's a good thing.
That's right. It is. Very much.
I mean, I think it's a gift from God, and I think it's why he would
withhold
that.
Well, she had a good question. I got people married third time in my congregation. You know, some divorce, some death. Who would they be hanging around with in heaven? See?
There really is no need for that type of relationship in heaven. That all you need will be fulfilled.
You will not be frustrated. You will absolutely not be frustrated. But if somehow the Lord has a way, now see, neither given or taken in marriage, see, he asked that. That's the question in verse 28. In the resurrection, whose wife of the seven will she be? For they all had her. Now, that word had her is that for sexual intercourse. And then he says specifically, it won't be that way. It'll be like angels. They're not talking about who. No, they don't have sexual intercourse. They're sexless. But there's no having of people. And,
I can't imagine that you could have those relationships in heaven without having argument and envy and all the things that we are surrounded with here. And there will be no sin in heaven.
Well, if God so desires to allow us to have it, it would be without sin. Absolutely. I don't have any problem with that.
But let's go back to my situation.
Yeah.
You know, I have an adopted daughter.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how I could share her with her mother when her mother claims her as her own.
Yeah. Because that wouldn't occur. There's no claiming as your own. You're all Christ. There is no claiming his own. See, that's where you have the problem. As soon as someone claims as their own, then you'd have an argument. But there's no claiming of one's own or such like that in heaven.
Well, she's definitely mine now.
Uh-huh. Well, no. She's Christ.
Well, she's mine. She's a child of God, but she's mine here on earth. As in a relationship. As a mother-daughter relationship.
Right. I have no problem with that. But she's going to be a husband pretty soon, another man. And she'll be closer to him than she was to you. Do you have problems with that? Then in heaven, if she meets her real mom, you're not going to have any problems anymore than you.
No, I know I won't.
No, that's right.
I know I won't have any problems with any relationship.
Right.
Because it's not like death. I mean, you had your mother here on earth, and then she
sure.
Died. And, you know, you don't spend every day worrying about what your relationship is there.
That's right. That's
you,
right.
You know, you know all of them have, you make their rational transition now.
Exactly. But I think the point you made is just absolutely correct. It'd be interesting. I'm not certain I could say at this point as pastor, there's not going to be sexual intercourse. It sure seems that way. If it's not there, there's no need. If it is there, you'll have a need. So anyone that I can be sure there's no fishing, I really doubt it. I doubt both of them. But boy, I'd have to either look. I think the Greek there, had her, definitely is referring to sexual intercourse. But if it's just referring to the relationship as wife. The only thing I can absolutely promise is that if it's not there, it won't bother you. Absolutely. Because you're going to have a totally different mind. I mean, we are just so, like, what makes a little baby happy? You know, crying for milk and you go over to the crib and give it a bottle. That's all it needs. It's not interested in learning the difference between Ptolemy and Copernicus, where some people just love sitting down and working all that out or working on computers. I mean, its mind is so out of computers. Boy, I love sitting down 3 hours at a computer and playing around. But positive. Now, what's the difference? Because of the mind. Now, when you get to heaven, your mind is going to be 1,000 times more than it is now. And so what we consider as this fun is going to be like a baby to...
You know, a communion soul or whatever, that is it's so great, you know, that it's just different.
Absolutely. It's like in a church service. That's the only times I taste what I think heaven's bliss is like, where all the other concerns, I couldn't care less if I get my new van, which I'm supposed to be going maybe by today, you know. You know, all those things just kind of pale into insignificance. Or when your child has got hit by a car and on, you know, in surgery and you're in the waiting room praying, you're going to care less if you go to a Chinese deal, dinner that night, or if you get married or nothing, because of that child. And so just like, you know, our own lives, the circumstances of the events change our level of ecstasy. Well, in heaven, it's just going to be such a different level.
You'll have a glorified body also.
Like Jesus did, right?
And so that...
Well, sure. So, well, that's an interesting question that you got there. That's very kind of good. But recognize it for what it is. That she's not really asking about whether or not she'll have that relationship with her husband. Her real concern is the doctrine of heaven itself and God. You know, is his love, view of love, my view of love. She's really questioning God here, not just the level of heaven. And so you have to deal with her on her psychological level, you know, and what I mean to say by that.
I don't think I can handle it.
Well?
Who can I refer her to God to?
Well, who's... It would have been interesting to have been there when her priest answered her. He probably gave her an answer, but she didn't consider an answer. Right.
Kathy, I remember what he said. He just looked at her. And he didn't
really answer that. Well, because from his point of view, as a priest particularly, when you're talking about the things of God, how can you be talking about things? You know, Kathy, you know, that guy, you know, because he's just taking a vow not to be involved with that. So they have quite a different view of, you know, from his point of view, it's like, here you're asking, well, can I keep sinning? You know, Kathy, you know. And she, her problem is probably, I bet you can make a good case that she's having to follow the first commandment, that her husband is her God and her relationship to her. I'll bet you that's really where it's at. But this is something, it's like in marriage counseling. The reason I don't say much in the first half hour of marriage isn't because I don't have advice to give. It's just that what they are saying is totally probably not the situation at all. You know, these are the symptoms of what's happened. He did this, he did that, he did that. You know, and you start saying, well, look, maybe if you had the meal on time, you know, you're missing the whole point there. It's just a breakdown of the relationship with God. It always is a breakdown of the relationship with God. And until that's fixed up, you might as well forget about trying to solve the marriage. All you're going to do is be putting Band-Aids on it. That's why secular counseling isn't worth anything. It can Band-Aid a marriage, but it can't make a marriage. Only Christianity can make a marriage. And but sometimes the answers are helpful. Like I was, you know, that one about the fishing, I thought it was an excellent answer, and then the guy was at peace. Because it didn't matter whether it was or there wasn't. He now knew that whatever was going to make him happy, I call that like a Sunday school level answer. The guy's still on milk. Now the meat of the word is like,
Well, she believes that. She believes that. Oh, it's really weird. She doesn't always believe in hell.
No, that most people don't.
Well, I mean,
yeah, you're right.
Her experience, I guess, was like an uncle who was in an operation like 10 years ago. Somebody slipped and they cut a nerve and he was paralyzed.
Yeah.
All that time.
Yeah.
So she equated, and he didn't, he wasn't
did she mean by that?
Well,
I said, whatever makes you happy in heaven, you'll have. Not whatever makes you happy on earth. Very important, yeah. When you get there, whatever makes you happy in heaven, you'll have it. And if that's the only thing that's going to make you happy in heaven, fishing, you'll have it. Now, the point is, you haven't answered his question at all. His question, but you've answered his concern. His concern is, can I really be in heaven and be in bliss, not having this? And the answer is, no, you can't. You can't be in heaven and be in bliss without having what you need. You will have it. But you change now. The thing is saying that, you know, like you said, what you need is going to change. Because I can't imagine my best friend in Canada, Don Gardner, is a Jew. And I know he's not going to be in heaven so far. You know, because he just rejects Christianity. And how am I going to be happy knowing my best friend isn't there? You know, that I had when I was a kid. I can't understand that.
You didn't bring that down to the level of being here on earth. Just like you have a concern for your family.
Sure.
And, you know, you think about your children getting married, and either marry a Catholic or a Jew.
Yeah.
How can a person be so open-minded and say, well, that's fine, you know, they worship God.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
If it's not good enough for you, how can it be good enough for the people you love very much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understand that for sure. I'm going to say something I forgot now. That pretty well covered, though,
what
love, don't forget. There's three words for love in the scriptures: agape, philia, and eros. Now that's Greek, but that comes from erotic. This is brotherly love, so Philadelphia, philia, and agape. There really isn't an English word. But this is love because of the thing, an object. Like, I love my pictures. You know, a guy was robbed in his house, and they said, you tell us where your money is, you know, open up the safe. He refused to do that, so they're going to beat up his wife. And he still refused. So then the guy took a match and was going to burn his pictures on the wall, and he opened up the safe. So he had more, he had eros for his pictures than he had for his love. Philia is brotherly love. I will do something for my brother that I won't do for a stranger, because he's my brother. I always find that interesting with robbers, you know, crooks, these gangsters, you know, they kill everybody. Brother and sister, but boy, if somebody touches their brother and sister, they get real angry. You know, that's philia. The agape is the kind of love that you do without reward. Christ died on the cross. He gained nothing from it. He suffered for it. And so that's the kind of love that we do. We contribute to the church not knowing that the people who receive it don't even know us. So we get no hope or reward or, you know, out of it. You do it just. It's selfless love. Now, Celia is her marriage love right now. She has such a close connection. And this is the love we're going to have in heaven, not this love. So theologically, that's the hook I would bring down to show her that she gets to be so close to this individual. I mean, she thinks more of him than she does other people, obviously. And that's not wrong to do. But recognize that if she really loves him, and before, say they weren't married yet, and another woman was in the situation, and he wanted to marry her, she would give him up freely without a doubt. That's agape. Agape is loving someone to such a degree that you're willing to serve them and let them be them as they are. She couldn't do that with him right now. You know, because she's got this love. She doesn't have that love. And the love that we have in heaven is this love to Jesus. So as soon as he says, in heaven, there's no fishing, don't bother me, there's no marriage guy. Don't bother me, because we have such a love. Lord, just say anything, and we're going to, oh, just love it. That he would even address us and have us with him. You know, that's kind of interesting. One of the parables, as I think back now, the big feast in heaven. And one of the guys says, well, I can't come because I got five oxen I got to test, which is kind of a comical thing, because he bought them already. Nobody buys oxen in the Near East without testing them for hours. You know, it's like going to buy, I just can't come and see, I just bought five new cars, I got to go see what they look like. Nobody does that. And the other guy says, I bought a house, I have to go see what it looks like. I mean, that's so stupid. I mean, Jesus was really a humorist there, and nobody would, I mean, they would be laughing all the way through this parable. And then the third thing is, I'm sorry, you know, I know I said to the king, I'm coming to your banquet, but, you know, I've got to go to bed with my wife. That's what the third excuse is, which is a total put down of the king, because nobody puts their wife in the Near East. She's just property, you know, in front of the banquet. So in a sense, that's like heaven. The oxen, you know, the cars we own, the property we own, and our relationship to our wives, all these are going to be insignificant in comparison to coming to the Feast of the King. It's just been a kind of an example of how, you know, the Feast of the King in that situation is related to marriage. It just isn't going to be an excuse. Yeah. Where you will go sell all that you have in order to buy the field just to get the pearl. Yeah. Sure. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
It's that valuable, we don't have to worry about what value we place on things. We have
that. That's right. Yeah.
Well, you know, I can relate to this
because we're all
human, but if you have that much hang up over what you have, it's almost like an idol.
Well, it is. Absolutely. That's right. Yeah. If your house burns down, you know, that's the Lord's will. And Jesus had that ability because he had total faith. Where he said, you know, thy will be done. You know, it wasn't his anyway. You know, nothing we own is, you know, how many of us sing that? We give thee but thine own, whatever the gift may be. All that we have is thine alone. We trust, O Lord, from thee. So nothing that we own anyway is ours. It's the Lord's. That's why stealing is such a sin. Because you're not stealing from people, you're stealing what belongs to God. And God has decided to disperse it in this way. And he's given it to this person, A. So when you steal from it, you are saying to God that his will is not correct. And you're correcting God's will. Sin is always unbelief in each situation. We haven't got to the third commandment, by the way. We're still in heaven. You know, you also made a very perceptive comment, and I think this is really true, that I think what's not taught enough today is hell. I think a lot of people don't believe in hell. Because, and the reason for that, remember, every time you have false theology, it is always because of a false view of God. When she says, let God be God, let God be God. This here is where the problem is. What does she mean by that second God? Nice. Very well put. Yeah, that's kind of a very good love. What she means by love and such. See, if we let God be God, we'd all be going to hell.
That's what we'll be talking about. First of all, we have to believe that everybody
has fallen
away.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that? We have
to stop with some of the other things.
Oh,
wow. Yeah. Well, this is good, though. In fact, I ran across a guy who visited the church and was brought by our friends, and he's into Hinduism, former ALC guy. And, boy, it was really interesting talking with him because of his view of the world. You know, he needs an intellect. religion thing. And, of course, immediately I just assumed he didn't understand Christianity, because anyone who understands Christianity is a Christian. I have never met anyone who can write down what I believe and present it. They always end up in law. And so he said, well, you know, I don't see much difference between the Muslim way of life and the Christian way of life. And I said, oh, yeah, I don't either. In fact, I think the Muslim is probably a superior way of life, because Christianity, we're not talking about a way of life at all. That's not what Christianity is about. And that really, you know, surprised me. Now, well, what is Christianity? And I said, well, we'll get together, you know. I tried to get him alone, you know, with the two friends that brought him. But you see, Christianity is seen like every other religion. It's a way of how you act toward other people. And see, once you buy into that nonsense, then it's very easy to stay away from church, because you say, Christians are nothing but a bunch of hypocrites. So they worship God on Sunday, and then they go out and sin all during the week. And my response to that is, well, what else is new? That is what a Christian is. We come in and confess that we cannot act as we're supposed to act. That's why we go to church, in order to receive good news, that we're forgiven of those things. And unfortunately, I see a lot of services these days, worship services, particularly sermons, where the Christian message is how to act right, how to respond properly. And that just blows my mind, because, I mean, what Jesus then, you know, I'm beginning to think that not only is it wrong to use Jesus as an example, but I think people are also using Jesus as motivator. Jesus will motivate you. You know, the Spirit will motivate you. All this kind of nonsense. And what's the goal of the sermon is to act properly. To act properly. You listen to every stewardship sermon. That's how it always ends. You know, therefore, if you really love Jesus, you will. You know, and where's the problem? You don't love him enough. So pray to him. Read the Bible. So the Bible and Jesus becomes the main goal, is to get you to act the way you should. Now, I think you should act the way God wants. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the Christian kernel of truth. The Christian kernel is that Jesus takes care of you when you don't act the way you should. What was the sermon I had Sunday? What was the gospel? I can't remember. But, what did I do? Was it 10 versions? No, that was Happy New Year, Advent. That's right, that's right. Yeah, I talked about what Advent was. Well, the gospel for Sunday was Palm Sunday. You know, and, you know, for 10 years now, I've never done it. I said, why would they have a Palm Sunday gospel on the first Sunday in Advent? So I thought, well, let me, you know, finally figure this out. I had some time last week. So the prophecy for Palm Sunday from the Old Testament is that your Lord is coming, see. And Advent, you know, Advent comes from the two Latin words, ad and venire. That means to come. That's a preposition to various meanings. So when we talk about Advent, we talk about Jesus coming. He came in the Bethlehem stable. He comes into your hearts. He comes on Judgment Day. So what I did, I took the Palm Sunday and I compared it to the Advent of him at Christmas, because we're in Christmas, and into our hearts now. And I said, and this will kind of answer the question what we're moving to here. The first thing I noticed about the Advent comings, all three of them, was that he always came in humility. What was his humility on Palm Sunday? See, that's very interesting, because that's the answer everyone gives. And most commentators, they talk about how he came. Well, it just so happens the donkey was like the Cadillac of the day. It's a royal beast of burden. King David rode into Jerusalem as victor on a donkey. Now, the donkey, there were two animals the kings rode on, horses and donkeys. The horse was the beast of war. The donkey is the beast of peace. So when Jesus came in to Jerusalem, riding on a donkey, the people from Bethany say, well, here, you know, it's fulfillment of the Old Testament, you know, and that's why they're singing the hallelujahs and such like that. His humility was not coming in on a donkey. It would be like me, you know, coming into St. Louis on a big Boeing and, you know, on a Cadillac downtown. That was a great honor. Where was his humility? His humility was that he was coming to Jerusalem to die. I mean, he was God of gods. He didn't have to come. And his humility was that he came like a common earthly king rather than the king of creation. He should have been coming in on the clouds of heaven with the angels going and everything. Instead, he just rides in like any other human being does. And he came to die. That's where his humility is. So I went to Christmas. Okay, where was the humility of Jesus when he was born? So when you Palm Sunday moving into Christmas, the question is, where was his humility? And where do people usually talk about that? What? Yeah, a swallowing clothes manger. Well, notice what you're pointing to again. You're pointing to the events. And some people say, boy, he should have been born in the king's palace. Well, no. Had he been born in the king's palace, that was still humility. Well, he came in like a king to Jerusalem. Where was his humiliation at Christmas?
He
was born at all. Yeah, that's where he set aside his divine powers. He still possessed them, but he didn't use them. Set them aside during his time of humiliation. Use the Father, the power of the Father. That's very critical, because you know, you say he was born in a stable and you know, laid in a. I think some of those events also, you know. But frankly, if you look at the Ken Bailey, the stable was part of the house. If you buy into his understanding of the Near East stable, it was part of the house, and it was kind of an honored place, actually. It was a guest room, and, you know, Mary and Joseph, it seems like they stayed in the inn the first time, but then they had the birth in the guest room, because that's where the wise men come. It's a different Greek word, where the wise men came in from where he was born. But be that as it may, it was not a particularly, people wouldn't look, oh, she was born in a cowshed. No, that was a kind of not an unusual thing. Now, you may not buy into his understanding. He tries to back it up with a lot of Eastern thinking the way they're doing it today, too. But be that as it may, his humility was he came at all. Now, he comes into us today. Does he come in humility? It's kind of hard to think of that, isn't it? Because in catechism, humiliation is a step down, and exaltation is a step up. Now, he's in his exalted state, but my point was, yes, he still does come in humility. How does he come?
He's been dwelling in a temple
person. Well, that's not a bad point. But he comes to us even in a means that is somewhat less than spectacular, namely to infants with a splash of water and to adults in a morsel of bread and a sip of wine. And to the eye of unbelief, there's no way they see the Lord there any more than the eye of unbelief saw him on Palm Sunday or the eye of unbelief in Herod saw him at Christmas. Which brought me to the third point, is that in all three situations, the response of the unbeliever and the believer were similar. The unbeliever, when they saw him coming at Palm Sunday, let's crucify him. The believer, they were making him a bread king. They misunderstood his coming. Christmas, the unbeliever, Herod, wanted to kill him. And the believer, they didn't realize he was born to die. The joy would have been somewhat missed. And look at his own parents later on. You know, what are you doing there? I need to be about my father's business. So even the believer sometimes misunderstands or misinterprets. And now for us too, the unbeliever, you know, today, well, you know, the many things against Christians going on throughout the world, as well as the attacks against us for our positions. But even the believer, boy, a lot of people think that Jesus is just an example. Use him as an example or something along that line.
don't believe in hell. And that is a very, I mean, that is so widespread.
All right, finish this sentence. God is, yeah, God is love. That's the vast majority of people think of that. Now, when they think of love, what is their definition of love? Love is the diminution, the lessening, the minimization of suffering. Love is reducing suffering.
What would you mean in heaven if there's no hell?
Well, if you're Teilhard de Chardin, a Roman Catholic, that everyone is going to heaven, you know. Jesus died for all. Therefore, everyone is going, whether they know it or not, the anonymous Christian. And Jehovah's Witnesses get around the problem because they can't understand a God in wrath either. So they say what hell is total annihilation. It's not a living existence. It's just destruction totally.
No.
Yeah. The only way you can look to hell is by belief. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can really think there's a hell. There's no way. The Christian, the only way you can understand hell is, what I mean by that, there are some things you know. For instance, you not only don't believe that Jesus is your Savior, you know Him to be. You don't live by faith there because you've been baptized and you trust Him. But when it comes to hell, you can't know hell. Because what we teach is that the infinite God of love will allow those in hell to continue to suffer eternally. I mean, again and again and again, not never stopping. I have to believe that by faith because that doesn't jive with my personal view of God. It does jive with my faith view of God, and I make a distinction between the two. Because the God of wrath is unmitigated in His wrath. I mean, He is so angry at sin, the only way that sin was mitigated is He had to kill His own Son. Nothing mitigates it except now faith in Christ. And anyone who lessens that need for faith in Christ is really saying to God, you really didn't have to kill Jesus. There was another way. I mean, nothing shows the severity of sin as much as the death of Christ. If you stop to think about it, God is nice, love, or whatever, that God would never kill Jesus. Absolutely. Okay. Now, let's examine that term, reasonable. What would be a synonym for reason? Because, well, I don't think so. Because it is absolutely logical that God would have a hell. It is absolutely logical that He would kill His Son. If you're talking reason in the sense of logic, absolutely. Even common sense. But, okay, when they say reason, they mean experience. It is not reasonable that if I love my children, I'm going to cause them to suffer. See, in there, and here again we get back, that unfortunately, when God tries to explain Himself, He has to use our experience because we have nothing but experience. And it always misses the point. And it's people then who take it to the next step where false doctrine always occurs. They say, okay, if God is loving like a father, what father ever would send us? See? Well, God says He's loving like a father in certain aspects, but not in that aspect. I can even prove to you that a loving father will be his child. See, as soon as you hear that, oh, what do you mean by that? Yeah. You have a little girl who's going up to a hot stove, and there's boiling water. And you say, okay, Mary, don't do that. You say, I'm going to do that. You say, okay. And you let her pull down the hot boiling water all over her. See? We would arrest such a parent. But the parent who goes over there and says, Mary, don't touch that. If that's the only way to sign it, hit her. Mary's view of that parent at that point is, oh, gee, thanks, Dad. I appreciate that. God does this all the time to us. Hebrews 12 is called discipline. It is never called punishment. Any more than when she goes over there and I hit her, I'm not punishing her. I'm disciplining her. I'm giving her an act of suffering to keep her from a greater act of suffering. And only those who love their children will discipline them. Now, you may have other ways. You may say, okay, go sit in the corner. You don't have to necessarily hit the child. But recognize from the child's point of view that it's always an act of unlove. It is always an act of unlove because they're thinking a parent is nice. That's what they mean by love. Now, what we have done then is taken that view of our fathers and parents and put it on God. And when people question our theology, they are always questioning God's nature. They always are. So law and gospel need to be kept apart because under the law you meet nothing but a wrathful God. There's no room for grace under law. There's no grace at all. It is just justice. And that means you give a person what they deserve. And since they deserve eternal hell, God is totally God when he sends a person to hell. I have no problem with that at all. But when you're under the gospel, there is no room for wrath. There's no room for justice. There's none of it. There's nothing but grace. And so the two have to be kept absolutely different. Because when you're dealing with people under the gospel, there is no demand. There are no demands. Therefore, there are no, at the end of sermons, therefore may we, or therefore let us. Because you put the person right back under the gospel. Because you're giving him the impression, okay, since he's done this, therefore, ought we not? And the answer is, no, we ought not. No, we ought not. We ought not have to do that. Because his grace is free, without condition. He takes you just as you are, and has forgiven you. Now, the Christian will automatically begin to do good works without having to be told to do so. Because the earlier part of the sermon was showing where we're going wrong and such. But when you get the gospel, boy, to apply it then to our lives, he always ends up using Christ as motivation to do what's right. And that's a shame. Unfortunately, we bought into that because most of our evangelism is reformed. most of our stewardship stuff is reformed. Well, we never did get to the third commandment, did we? Well, that'll be something to look forward to next week. We do meet next week. Well, I don't know. Remember, we're just moving through the year, and something like this, I always enjoy it because...
No, that's good. I'm glad you did.
No, that's good. Well, we don't have an agenda. You know, if you don't have something, I'm prepared with something. But if you have something, I think we all appreciate it. You know, the question, and it alerts us to something else, too, is that you are God's representative, and he may end up having you be confronted with someone who's asking really an eternal question, even though it just seems like a very simple one, and he will always give you the words to say. He will always give you the words to say. Now, what did he do in your situation? The words to say is that, okay, I'll bring this to the attention of the Bible study I'm at. Those were the words to say. And you never have to be embarrassed. So when I was at the seminary, I was confronted with a lot of theology that I knew was wrong, but I didn't know why it was wrong. It sounded commonsensical. It sounded rational. I knew it wasn't what the Bible was saying, but I could not explain it away. And I, after my first just few months here, I was just deluged with this stuff. And most of my friends all went liberal. And I said to myself, somewhere there's a conservative who has an answer to that. And until I hear his answer, I won't make a decision. And then when I sat down with these conservative guys like Price and Bowman and such, and listened to them, I said, oh, yeah, why didn't I think of that? That's so simple. You know, I mean, there are answers. But... And no pastor is God. He, too, has to go back to the resources. Because, see, every age has a whole new system of attack against the Word. You know, that you never like. You sit down with a Mormon, whoever thought you needed verses that we don't have planets that we're going to with all these lies? You know, we don't even think in those terms, you know. So you're confronted with a whole new thing. Now, the Bible answers those. It's just you were never taught them because those were never issues in your day. Euthanasia is another good example. When I was going through the seminar, it was a big question. We had no real understanding of where we would go. Now, we have documents. They've studied it. They brought it out. Now I'm very clean on euthanasia. I got no problem with that. But what's the new one now? Baboon heart transplants. Brain transplants. See, now we got to start really looking to, you know, what does it fit into the Christian understanding of things?
A woman serving in the church. That's a lady older,
well, it's in new ways. Yeah, new ways. Because we have new, teachers and our ministers of religion. You know, in our church, as over the last, because the term minister has a different concept than when I grew up with it. See, it's an IRS term. That's what we mean by it. When we talk about the ministers in the synod, we're talking IRS language. We're not talking theological language. Okay, so absolutely, that's why I voted against it. I voted against it. I was a delegate at that convention. I voted against it for two reasons. Number one, I voted against it because of the confusion of the two. I didn't think we were going to get it straight. Although right now there's really a big difference between a teacher and a pastor. In the old days, the male teacher, you had the pastor, and you had the male teacher, and you had the female teacher. And I did it purposely like that. The male teacher was often seen as an assistant to the pastor. In fact, in the old days, they were. They preached when the pastor was gone, this kind of thing. And the female teacher was down here. Now, what our new guidelines have shown is here's the pastor, and now here's the male teacher. Down here, and the female teacher, they're absolutely equal. There's no distinction at all between the two. And, I think practically speaking, but going now to our guidelines, they're seen as identical. And the male teacher has lost, I think, something. Oh, no. In some congregations, it's no longer true. So the other point I want to make, I also voted against it, because what was the resolution doing? It was giving female teachers self-employment status. Now, you know what we've done? This is why I voted against it. 10 years ago, that was all right. Have self-employment status because it was what 7.1% I paid. If you're an employee of the church, what is it? The church pays 7 and you pay 7. Now, this continues, but now we're up to 12.7%, I think next year, self-employment tax. So now, you know what we've just done for our female teachers? We have now made them pay their own Social Security, which is 5% more than what they were paying before, and the congregation not helping them at all. If they want that status, that's fine, but they're just throwing their money away. In other words, when you were employees, when women teachers were employed, the church picked up half. Now that you're self-employed, they don't pick up anything. So I voted against it because we were trying to get females and males to have an equal wage. And now the women are even making less, because you're right, in some congregations, males just get more than females. Well, you know why? Like in Emmanuel, you get money for how many extra years, like if you have a master's and stuff like that. What woman has really the time to get out master's? And we've got kids and stuff like that.
Even if they have, they still get paid less.
No. In some congregations, but like in Emmanuel, the pay rate's the same for everybody. Lutheran High North, Perry, it's the same. It doesn't matter what sex you are. If you have this much training, you've been out there that much, that's your salary scale. So, now I disagree with that. I do. I don't think
that a female should make the same as a man.
Absolutely. I disagree with the principle. I think that a female teacher who comes to St. James to be a parochial school teacher who has just got out of River Forest is a widow with 3 children should get more money than a male teacher who's been there 5 years who's single. Because according to the Bible, you are supposed to take care of your people to the degree that they need to be taken care of. And once you are locked into a salary scale, that woman who comes as a widow with three kids, she isn't going to be getting near what she should be getting to take care of her kids. This is what we do with pastors. Well, we don't just rate them on, you know, how many years. If I, for instance, if my wife died, you know, and I needed, you know, help in that, I wouldn't hesitate to go to the church and say, I need, you know, an aide to come in and do this. Would you pick it up? And the church should pick it up. In other words, when you get tied into salary scales and you don't look just also at needs, you might want to bait. But I think that woman, but I'm saying that the woman teacher there should have got more money than the male. Well, that's where the pastor's supposed to be, right?
Right, yeah.
People may not... They don't refer to me often as revolutionary. Controversy. In other words, we think too much like the world does. We really do. And the Bible just doesn't think in those terms. You know, we get thrown right in with the world and say, oh, we're all fighting for equal pay, equal, and it's ridiculous. Now, when the scriptures make very clear that we're supposed to take care of our workers, and the reason we're finding equal pay is because for so long, you know, male teachers would get a house plus salary in the old days. A woman teacher coming? See, in my church, if a woman came, she was a widow, I'd give her a house plus salary. And if the male teacher already had a house, his wife was working or something, he wouldn't get a house. Just like we do with pastors. A pastor has a choice. Does he want a house or does he want, you know, the rental value of it? So I think teachers should have those. In other words, when you're going to really treat people equally, it means you have to have the freedom to give them different pay, you know, depending on their needs. And I think, you know.
How does he have that document line?
The same way we do calls for a pastor. When we call a pastor, for instance, I'm a circuit counselor, I know how it works. We just called a pastor, and it was $13,000. He says he'd like to take the call, but he needs $2,000 more to cover some of his debts and this house he's selling, this kind of stuff. So we go back to the congregation, here's your situation, and they make up their mind. I don't know what this one will do, but the congregation that had Emmanuel, they ended up giving him $4,000 more plus a full loan for a new house that he's paying back.
Some pastors won't ask. You know, they'll
take whatever economy is given, even if it's
subsistence.
And then you have a new pastor in. Yeah. And he'll ask for the sun, the moon, the sky, whatever, and it'll all fall.
Maybe it will fall.
The pastor previous to me always asked. And they really love that pastor, but that's the one thing they criticize him about all the time. It looked like he was kind of money hungry. I do not believe pastors should ask at all. I think the elders should be smart enough to ask the pastors. Hi. Very good. In other words, it's just because of the old Adam in many of our congregational people. If the pastors, you know, ask it, you ought to have the best elders. My elders come to me, you know, when we have budget meeting, we just had it last month. They say, okay, Tom, you know, how did the salary do last year? And I said, fine. And then I walk out of the room. And then they decide my salary. I refuse to be in the room when they decide my salary. And also, when now, if I had a need, they've given me the opportunity. See, that's all the elders got to do. They give you the need thing. And then the elders always say, okay, like they raised it like 8% this year. And then it goes to the budget committee. And they always go up anyway. You know? And the first few years, I was hurting. But I just very... There's three things I don't talk about. There's money and there's congregation. Except on stewardship Sunday, my salary and race. Those three things I stay away from because it causes nothing but problems just the talking about it. Right. Black-white issues. St. James, I think we're pretty well mixed. I don't know what the percentage is because just... figuring it out means it's important and it's not important. The Black Commission always phones me. I say, well, what's your percentage of blacks? They say, when you ask me how many blue-eyed and brown-eyed people, I'll tell you. But the church just two blocks from us, totally black, and the church the other two blocks, totally white. And that's because it's important to them. You know, they talk about the issue all the time. It's just like we don't have women voters. We never had the need for it because the voters assembly is looked on as an inferior group. It's not a word sacrament group at all in the church. It's one of the lesser groups in the economy. What's much more important is evangelism, Bible study, Sunday school teaching, church worship, and this kind of thing. So when new members, we have not had a member join the voters assembly in 7 years. We did last voters. And it's one of our members who's been there 20 years and he retired and now wants to, you know, take more time. But in other words, the style of the pastor, and that's where you can really help your husbands, is his style and what you know, what he thinks is important will become important. And if the voters assembly is thought of as an important group, everybody wants to join it. And you have all kinds of problems. Our voters assembly, when I came there, we had 40 people there. We had 160 members. We now have 360 members, and we have 9 people in voters assembly. They do all the work. Because people trust, you know, the leadership in the congregation. But that took some years to get over. No, they trust. Because, okay, to prove that, when you ask for $100,000 and they have had no input as to whether we need the building and it comes in, it won't come. The people put their money where their trust is. And to also prove that, we have the biggest voters assembly when there's a problem in the church. And we insist on a voters assembly every month. So if there is a problem, they come. For instance, we had a new organist. Boy, did he play loud. You know, I liked it. But we had a guy who has a medal in his head because of the war, and he came to voters to complain about that. So when there is a need, or, you know, if you call a pastor, you better have the ability to have a lot of voters there, you know. But your people will just not cooperate with you if they don't trust you. And they won't come to church. They won't, you know, volunteer for Sunday school teacher or anything. Now, there are people who will absolutely in every congregation. And those are people, you know, you have kind of dead sleeping wood all the time in the congregation. But it seems to me where people don't care that much about what the church is, they don't show up. And if they do, they're showing up at voters because that's where they think the power is. Well, we went over our time a little bit here, but next week we will maybe attempt to start on third commandment, but if we don't get to it, no big deal. Let me close with a short prayer then. Heavenly Father, our Father who art in heaven, we do thank you very much that you have given us some information concerning heaven, but you have kept us dark about other portions of that revelation. We know that we have enough to trust you and to look forward to heaven, knowing full well that when we arrive there, all things will be to our bliss. In the name of Jesus who died so that we are able to arrive in heaven, we pray. Amen.